an artificial humanoid created with a limited lifespan, but implanted with false childhood memories, so you think you're really a real person, except you're really going to die soon. And I look at Denny hard and say, "So, dude, my mom told you I'm some kind of robot? Is that what her diary says?" Denny says. Two women come up, holding a camera, and one says, "Do you mind?" "Say cheese," I tell them, and snap their picture smiling in front of the cowshed. Then they walk away with another fleeting moment that almost got away, another petrified moment to treasure. "No, I haven't read the diary," I say. "I haven't fucked Paige Marshall. I can't do jack shit until I decide about this." "Okay, okay," Denny says. To me, he says, "Then are you really just a brain in a pan somewhere, being stimulated with chemicals and electricity into thinking you have a real life?" "No," I go, "I'm definitely not a brain, that's not it." "Okay," he says, "maybe you're an artificially intelligent computer program that interacts with programs in a simulated reality." And I go, "What does that make you?" "I'd just be another computer," Denny says. Then he says, "I get your point, dude. I can't even figure out change for the bus." Denny narrows his eyes and tilts his head back, looking at me with one eyebrow cocked. "Here's my last guess," he says. He says, "Okay, the way I figure it, you're just the subject of an experiment, and the whole world you know is just an artificial construct, populated by actors who play the roles of everybody in your life, and the weather is just special effects, and the sky is painted blue, and the landscape everywhere is just a set. Is that it?" And I go, "Huh?" "And I'm really a talented and gifted actor," Denny says, "and I'm just pretending to be your stupid, masturbation-addicted loser best friend." Somebody snaps a picture of me gritting my teeth, and I look at Denny and say, "Dude, you're not pretending anything." At my elbow is some tourist guy grinning at me. "Victor, hey," he says, "so this is where you work?" Where he knows me from, I haven't the foggiest. Medical school, college, a different job. Or it could be he's just another sex maniac from my group. It's funny, he doesn't look like a sexaholic, but nobody ever does. "Hey, Maud," he says, and he elbows the woman he's with. "This is the guy I'm always telling you about. I saved this guy's life." And the woman says, "Oh my gosh, so it's true." She pulls her head into her shoulders and rolls her eyes. "Reggie here is always bragging about you. I guess I always thought he was exaggerating." "Oh yeah," I say, "old Reg here, yeah, he saved my life." And Denny says, "Any more, who hasn't?" Reggie says, "Are you making out okay these days? I tried to send as much cash as I could. Was it enough to take care of that wisdom tooth you needed yanked?" And Denny says, "Oh, for crying out loud." A blind chicken with half a head and no wings, shit smeared all over it, stumbles against my boot, and when I reach down to pet it, the thing's quivering inside its feathers. It makes a soft, clucking, cooing sound that's almost a purr. It's nice to see something more pathetic than I feel right now. Then I catch myself with a fingernail in my mouth. Cow crap. Chicken shit. See also histoplasmosis. See also tapeworms. And I go, "Yeah, the money," I say. "Thanks, dude." And I spit. Then I spit again. There's the click of Reggie taking my picture. Just another stupid moment people have to make last forever. And Denny looks at the newspaper in my hand and he says, "So dude, can I come live at your mom's house? Yes or no?" Chapter 20. The mommy's 3 o'clock appointment would show up clutching a yellow bath towel, and around his finger would be the blank groove where there should be a wedding ring. The second the door was locked, he'd try and give her the cash. He'd start to take off his pants. His name was Jones, he'd tell her. His first name, Mister. Guys here to see her for the first time were all the same. She'd tell him, "Pay me after. Don't be in such a rush. Keep all your clothes on. There's no hurry." She'd tell him the appointment book was full of Mr. Joneses, Mr. Smiths, John Does, and Bob Whites, so he'd better come up with a better alias. She'd tell him to lie down on the couch, close the blinds, dim the lights. This is how she could make a pile of money. It didn't violate the terms of her parole, but only because the parole board lacked imagination. To the guy on the couch, she'd say, "Shall we get started?" Even if a guy said he wasn't after sex, the mommy would still tell him to bring a towel. You brought a towel. You paid in cash. Don't ask her to bill you later or bill some insurance company because she just couldn't be bothered. You pay cash, then you file the claim. You only get 50 minutes. Guys had to know what they wanted. This means the woman, the positions, the setting, the toys. Don't spring anything fancy on her at the last minute. She'd tell Mr. Jones to lie back, close his eyes. Allow all the tension in your face to melt away, your forehead first, let it go slack. Relax the spot between your eyes. Imagine your forehead smooth and relaxed. Then the muscles around your eyes, smooth and relaxed. Then the muscles around your mouth, smooth and relaxed. Even if guys said they were just looking to lose some weight, they wanted sex. If they wanted to quit smoking, manage stress, quit biting their nails, cure hiccups, stop drinking, clear up their skin, whatever the issue, it was because they weren't getting laid. Whatever they said they wanted, they'd get sex here and the problem was solved. If the mommy was a compassionate genius or a slut, you don't know. Sex pretty much cures everything. She was the best therapist in the business, or she was a whore that fucked with your mind. She didn't like being so slam-bam with her clients, but she never planned to earn a living this way. This kind of session, the sex kind, first happened by accident. A client who wanted to quit smoking wanted to be regressed to the day he was 11 and took his first puff, so he could remember how bad it tasted, so he could quit by going back and never starting. That was the basic idea. On his second session, this client wanted to meet with his father, who was dead of lung cancer, just to talk. This is still pretty much normal. People want to meet with famous dead people all the time, for guidance, for advice. It was so real that on his third session, the client wanted to meet Cleopatra. To each client, the mommy said, "Let all the tension drain from your face to your neck, then from your neck to your chest. Relax your shoulders. Allow them to roll back and press into the couch. Imagine a heavy weight pressing your body, settling your head and arms deeper and deeper into the cushions of the couch. Relax your arms, your elbows, your hands. Feel the tension trickle down into each finger. Then relax and imagine the tension draining out through each fingertip." What she did was put him in a trance, hypnotic induction, and guide the experience. He wasn't going back in time. None of it was real. What was important is he wanted this to happen. The mommy, she just gave the play-by-play story, the blow-by-blow description, the color commentary. Imagine listening to a baseball game over the radio. Imagine how real it can seem. Now imagine it from inside a heavy, theta-level trance, a deep trance where you hear and smell, you taste and feel. Imagine Cleopatra rolling out of her carpet, naked and perfect and everything you've always wanted. Imagine Salome. Imagine Marilyn Monroe. If you could go back to any period in history and get with any woman, women who would do anything you could imagine, incredible women, famous women, the theater of the mind, the bordello of the subconscious, that's how it started. Sure, what she did was hypnosis, but it wasn't real past life regression. It was more a kind of guided meditation. She'd tell Mr. Jones to focus on the tension in his chest and let it recede, let it flow down to his waist, his hips, his legs. Imagine water spiraling down a drain. Relax each part of your body and let the tension flow down to your knees, your shins, your feet. Imagine smoke drifting away. Let it diffuse. Watch it vanish, disappear, dissolve. In her appointment book, next to his name, it said Marilyn Monroe, the same as most guys here for their first time. She could live on just doing Marilyn. She could live on just doing Princess Diana. To Mr. Jones, she said, "Imagine you're looking up at a blue sky, and imagine a tiny airplane skywriting the letter Z. Then let the wind erase the letter. Then imagine the plane writing the letter Y. Let the wind erase it. Then the letter X. Erase it. Then the letter W. Let the wind erase it." All she really did was set the stage. She just introduced men to their ideal. She set them up on a date with their subconscious because nothing is as good as you can imagine it. No one is as beautiful as she is in your head. Nothing is as exciting as your fantasy. Here you'd have sex you'd only dreamt about. She'd set the stage and make the introductions. The rest of the session, she'd watch the clock and maybe read a book or do a crossword puzzle. Here, you'd never be disappointed. Buried deep in his trance, a guy would lie there and twitch and hump, a dog chasing rabbits in a dream. Every few guys, she'd get a screamer or a moaner or a groaner. You had to wonder what the people in the room next door would think. Guys in the waiting room heard the fuss and it would drive them wild. After the session, a guy would be soaked with sweat, his shirt wet and sticking to him, his pants stained. Some could pour the sweat out of their shoes. They could shake it out of their hair. The couch in her office was scotch-guarded, but it never really got a chance to really dry out. Now it's sealed inside a clear plastic slipcover, more to keep the years of mess inside than to protect it from the outside world. So guys each had to bring a towel, in their briefcases, in paper bags, in their gym bags, with a clean change of clothes. In between clients, she'd spray around room fresheners. She'd open the windows. To Mr. Jones, she'd say, "Make all the tension in your body collect in your toes, then drain out. All the tension. Imagine your whole body slack, relaxed, collapsed, relaxed, heavy, relaxed, empty, relaxed. Breathe with your stomach instead of your chest. In and then out. In and then out. Breathing in and then out. Smooth and even. Your legs are tired and heavy. Your arms are tired and heavy." At first, what the stupid little boy remembers is the mommy did house cleansings. Not any kind of vacuuming or dusting, but spiritual cleansings, exorcisms. The hardest part was getting the people at the Yellow Pages to run her ad under the heading Exorcist. You go and burn sage, say the Lord's Prayer and walk around, maybe beat a clay drum, declare the house clean. Clients will pay for just doing that. Cold spots, bad smells, eerie feelings. Most people don't need an exorcist. They need a new furnace or a plumber or an interior decorator. The point is, it's not important what you think. What's important is that they're sure they have a problem. Most of those jobs come through realtors. In this city, we have a real estate disclosure law, and people will admit to the dumbest faults, not just asbestos and buried oil tanks, but ghosts and poltergeists. Everybody wants more excitement from their life than they'll ever get. Buyers on the verge of closing, they'll need a little reassurance about the house. The realtor calls, and you put on a little show, burn some sage, and everybody wins. They get what they want, plus a good story to tell, an experience. Then came feng shui, the kid remembers, and the clients wanted an exorcism, and they wanted her to tell them where to put the sofa. Clients would ask, where did the bed need to go to avoid being in the path of cutting chi from the corner of the dresser? Where should they hang mirrors to bounce the flow of chi back upstairs or away from open doors? It turned into that kind of job. This is what you do with a graduate degree in English. Just her resume was proof of reincarnation. With Mr. Jones, she'd run through the alphabet backwards. She'd tell him, "You are standing in a grassy meadow, but now the clouds will descend, coming lower and lower, settling over you until they're all around you in a dense fog, a dense, bright fog. Imagine standing in a bright, cool fog. The future is to your right side, the past to your left. The fog is cool and wet on your face. Turn to your left and start walking. Imagine," she'd tell Mr. Jones, "a shape just ahead of you in the fog. Keep walking. Feel the fog start to lift. Feel the sun bright and warm on your shoulders. The shape is closer. With every step, the shape is more and more clear. Here, in your mind, you have complete privacy. Here, there's no difference between what is and what could be. You're not going to catch any disease or crab lice or break any law or settle for any less than the best of everything you can imagine. You can do anything you can imagine." She'd tell each client, "Breathe in, then out. You can have anyone, anywhere, in, then out." From feng shui, She went to channeling. Ancient gods, enlightened warriors, dead pets, she'd faked them. Channeling led to hypnosis and past life regression. Regressing people led her here, to 9 clients every day at $200 per, to guys in the waiting room all day, to wives calling and yelling at the little boy. I know he's there. I don't know what he claims, but he's married. To wives sitting in cars outside, calling on car phones to say, don't think I don't know what's going on up there. I followed him. It's not as if the mommy started with the idea of summoning up the most powerful women in history to give hand jobs, blow jobs, half and half and around the world. It just snowballed. The first guy talked. A friend of his called. A friend of the second guy called. At first they all asked for help to cure something legit, smoking or chewing tobacco, spitting in public, shoplifting. Then they just wanted sex. They wanted Clara Bow and Betsy Ross and Elizabeth Tudor and the Queen of Sheba. And every day she was running down to the library to research the next day's women. Eleanor Roosevelt, Amelia Earhart, Harriet Beecher Stowe. In and then out. Guys called wanting to pork Helen Hayes, Margaret Sanger, and Amy Semple McPherson. They wanted to bone Edith Piaf, Sojourner Truth, and the Empress Theodora. And at first it bothered the mommy how all these guys were obsessed with only dead women, and how they never asked for the same woman twice, and no matter how much detail she put into a session, they only wanted to pork and bone, slam and bump, shaft, hole, screw, drill, pound, pile drive, core, and ride. And sometimes the euphemism just isn't. Sometimes a euphemism is more true than what it's supposed to hide. And this really wasn't about sex. These guys meant just what they asked for. They didn't want conversation or costumes or historical accuracy. They wanted Emily Dickinson naked in high heels with one foot on the floor and the other up on her desk, bent over and running a quill pen up the crack of her butt. They'd pay $200 to go into a trance and find Mary Cassatt wearing a push-up bra. It wasn't every man who could afford her, so she'd get the same type again and again. They'd park their minivans 6 blocks away and hurry over to the house, staying near the buildings, each guy dragging his shadow. They'd stumble in wearing dark glasses, then wait behind open newspapers and magazines until their name was called, or their alias. If the mommy and the stupid little boy ever met them in public, these men would pretend not to know her. In public, they'd have wives. In the supermarket, they'd have kids. In the park, dogs. They'd have real names. They'd pay her with damp 20s and 50s from sopping wet wallets full of sweaty photos, library cards, charge cards, club memberships, licenses, change, obligations, responsibility, reality. Imagine, she'd tell each client, the sun on your skin. Feel the sun getting warmer and warmer with each breath you exhale. The sun bright and warm on your face, your chest, your shoulders. Breathe in, then out. In, then out. Her repeat customers, now they all wanted girl-on-girl shows. They'd want a two-girl party. Indira Gandhi and Carol Lombard, Margaret Mead and Audrey Hepburn and Dorothea Dix. Repeat clients didn't even want to be real themselves. The bald ones would ask for full, thick hair. The fat ones ask for muscle. The pale, tans. After enough sessions, every man would ask for a strutting, foot-long erection. So it wasn't real past-life regression. And it wasn't love. It wasn't history, and it wasn't reality. It wasn't television, but it happened in your mind. It was a broadcast, and she was the sender. It wasn't sex. She was just the tour guide for a wet dream, a hypno lap dancer. Each guy kept his pants on for damage control. Containment. The mess went way beyond just Peter tracks, and it paid a fortune. Mr. Jones would get the standard Maryland experience. He'd be rigid on the couch, sweating and mouth breathing, his eyes rolled back, his shirt would go dark under the arms, his crotch would tent up. Here she is, the mommy would tell Mr. Jones. The fog is gone, and it's a shining hot day. Feel the air on your bare skin, your bare arms and legs. Feel yourself getting warmer with every breath you breathe out. Feel yourself growing longer and thicker. Already you're harder and heavier, more purple and throbbing than you've ever felt. Her watch said they had about 40 minutes left before the next client. The fog is gone, Mr. Jones, and the shape in front of you is Marilyn Monroe in a tight satin dress, golden and smiling, her eyes half closed, her head tilts back. She stands in a field of tiny flowers and lifts her arms, and as you step closer, her dress slips to the ground. To the stupid little boy, the mommy used to say, this wasn't sex. These weren't real women, as much as they were symbols, projections, sex symbols. The power of suggestion. To Mr. Jones, the mommy would say, have at her. She'd say, she's all yours. Chapter 21. That first night, Denny's outside the front door holding something wrapped in a pink baby blanket. This is all through the peephole in my mom's door. Denny in his giant plaid coat, Denny cradling some baby to his chest, his nose bulging, his eyes bulging, everything bulging because of the peephole lens, everything distorted. His hands clutching the bundle are white with the effort. And Denny yells, open up, dude. And I open the door as far as the burglar chain will go. I go, what you got there? And Denny tucks a blanket around his little bundle and says, what's it look like? It looks like a baby, dude, I say. And Denny says, good. He hefts the pink bundle and says, let me in, dude, this is getting heavy. Then I slip the chain. I step aside, and Denny charges in and over to one living room corner where he heaves the baby onto the plastic-covered sofa. The pink blanket rolls, and out rolls a rock, gray and granite-colored, scrubbed and smooth-looking. No baby, for real, just this boulder. Thanks for the baby idea, Denny says. People see a young guy with a baby, and they're sweet to you, he says. They see a guy carrying a big rock, and they get all tensed up, especially if you want to carry it on the bus. He tucks one edge of the pink blanket under his chin and starts folding it against his front and says, plus, with a baby, you always get a seat. And if you forget your money, they don't kick you off. Denny flops the folded blanket over his shoulder and says, this is your mom's house? The dining room table is covered with today's birthday cards and checks. My thank you letters. The big book of who and where. Beside that's my mom's old 10-key adding machine. The kind with a long slot machine handle you pull along one side. Sitting back down, I start doing today's deposit slip and say, yeah, it's her house until the property tax people kick me out in a few months. Denny says, it's good you got a whole house since my folks want all my rocks to move out with me. Dude, I say, how many do you got? He's got a rock for every day he has sobriety, Denny says. It's what he does at night to stay occupied, find rocks, wash them, haul them home. It's how his recovery is going to be about doing something big and good instead of just not doing little bad shit. It's so I don't act out, dude, he says. You have no idea how tough it is to find good rocks in a city. I mean, not like chunks of concrete or those plastic rocks people hide their extra keys inside. The total for today's checks is $75, all from strangers who Heimlich maneuvered me in some restaurant somewhere. This is nowhere near what I figure a stomach tube has got to cost. To Denny, I say, so how many days you got so far? 127 rocks worth, Denny says. He comes around the table next to me, looking at the birthday cards, looking at the checks, and says, so where's your mom's famous diary? He picks up a birthday card. You can't read it, I say. Denny says, sorry, dude, and starts to put the card down. No, I tell him, the diary. It's written in some foreign language. That's why he can't read it. I can't read it. How my mom thinks is she probably wrote it that way so I'd never sneak through it when I was a kid. Dude, I say, I think it's Italian. And Denny says, Italian? Yeah, I go, you know, like spaghetti? Still with his big plaid coat on, Denny says, you eat yet? Not yet. I seal the deposit envelope. Denny says, you think they're going to banish me tomorrow? Yes, no, probably. Ursula saw him with a newspaper. The deposit slip is ready for the bank tomorrow. All the thank you letters, the under letters, are signed and stamped and ready to mail. I get my coat from the sofa. Next to it, Denny's rock is squashing the springs down. So what's with these rocks, I say. Denny's opened the front door, and he's standing there while I turn off some lights. In the doorway, he says, I don't know. But rocks are like, you know, land. It's like these rocks are a kit. It's land, but with some assembly required. You know, land ownership. But for right now, it's indoors. I say for sure. We go out, and I lock the door behind us. The night sky is all fuzzy with stars. Out of focus, there's no moon. Outside on the sidewalk, Denny looks up at the mess and says, "What I think happened is when God wanted to make the earth out of chaos, the first thing he did was to just get a lot of rocks together." While we walk, his new obsessive compulsion has my eyes scanning vacant lots and places for rocks we can pick up. Walking down to the bus stop with me, still with a pink baby blanket folded over one shoulder, Denny says, "I only take the rocks nobody wants." He says, "I'll just get one rock every night. Then I'll figure out the next part, you know, next." It's such a creepy idea, us taking home rocks. We're collecting land. "You know that girl, Daiquiri?" Denny says. "The dancer with a cancery mole," he says. "You didn't sleep with her, did you?" We're shoplifting real property, burgling terra firma. And I say, "Why not? We're just an outlaw couple of land rustlers." And Denny says, "Her real name is Beth." The way Denny thinks, he's probably got plans to start his own planet. Chapter 22. Dr. Paige Marshall stretches a string of something white, tight between her two gloved hands. She stands over a deflated old woman in a recliner chair, and Dr. Marshall says, "Mrs. Wintower, I need you to open your mouth as wide as you can. Latex gloves. The yellow way they make your hands look, this is how cadaver skin looks. The medical cadavers from first year anatomy, with their shaved heads and pubic hair, the little stubble of the hairs, the skin could be chicken skin, cheap stewing chicken, turning yellow and dimpled with follicles. Feathers or hair, it's all just keratin. The muscles of the human thigh look the same as dark meat turkey. During first year anatomy, you can't look at chicken or turkey and not be eating a cadaver." The old woman tilts her head back to show her teeth wedged in their brown curve, her tongue coated white. Her eyes are closed. This is how all these old women look at communion, at Catholic Mass, when you're an altar boy and you have to follow along with the priest as he puts the wafer on tongue after old tongue. The church says you can receive the host into your hands, then feed yourself, but not these old ladies. In church, you'll still look down at the communion rail and see 200 open mouths, 200 old ladies stretching their tongues toward salvation. Paige Marshall leans in and forces a white string between the old woman's teeth. She pulls, and when the string twangs out from the mouth, some soft gray bits flick out. She runs the string between two more teeth, and the string comes out red. For bleeding gums, see also oral cancers, see also necrotizing, ulcerative gingivitis. The only good part about being an altar boy is you get to hold the patent under the chin of each person receiving communion. This is a gold platter on a stick you use to catch the host if it falls. Even if a host hits the floor, you still have to eat it. At this point, it's consecrated. It's become the body of Christ, the flesh incarnate. I watch from behind while Paige Marshall puts the bloody string back into the old woman's mouth again and again. Gray and white bits of smear collect on the front of Paige's lab coat, little specks of pink. A nurse leans in the doorway and says, "Everybody okay in here?" To the old woman in the chair, she says, "Paige isn't hurting you, is she?" The old woman gargles an answer. The nurse says, "What was that?" The old woman swallows and says, "Dr. Marshall is very gentle. She's more gentle than when you do my teeth." "Almost done," Dr. Marshall says. "You are being so good, Mrs. Wintower." And the nurse shrugs and leaves. The good part of being an altar boy is when you hit somebody in the throat with a paten. People on their knees with their hands clasped in prayer, the little gaggy face they make right at the moment when they're being so divine. I loved that. As the priest puts the host on their tongue, he'll say, "Body of Christ." And the person kneeling for communion will say, "Amen." What's best is to hit their throat so the amen comes out as a gaga baby sound, or they make a duck quack, or a chicken cluck. Still, you have to do this by accident, and you have to not laugh. "All done," Dr. Marshall says. She straightens up, and when she goes to toss the bloody string in the trash, she sees me. I didn't want to interrupt, I say. She's helping the old woman out of the recliner and says, Mrs. Wintour, can you send Mrs. Tunemitsu in to see me? Mrs. Wintour nods. Through her cheeks, you can see her tongue stretching around inside her mouth, feeling her teeth, sucking her lips into a tight pucker. Before she steps into the hallway, she looks at me and says, Howard, I've forgiven you for cheating on me. You don't have to keep coming around. Remember to send in Mrs. Tunemitsu, says Dr. Marshall. And I say, so? And Paige Marshall says, so I have to do dental hygiene all day. What do you need? I need to know what it says in my mom's diary. Oh, that, she says. She's snapping off her latex gloves and stuffing them into a hazardous waste container. The only thing that diary proves, she says, is that your mom was delusional before you were born. Delusional how? Paige Marshall looks at a clock on the wall. She waves at the chair, the vinyl, leather-look recliner Mrs. Wintour just left, and says, take a seat. She's stretching on a new pair of latex gloves. She wants to floss my teeth. It will help with your breath, she says. She spools out a length of dental floss and says, sit, and I'll tell you what's in the diary. So I sit, and my weight pushes a cloud of bad stink out of the recliner. That wasn't me, I say. That smell, I mean, I didn't do that. And Paige Marshall says, before you were born, your mother spent some time in Italy, right? So that's the big secret, I say? And Paige says, what? That I'm Italian? No, Paige says. She leans into my mouth. But your mother is Catholic, isn't she? The stare as she snaps it between a couple teeth. Please be joking, I say. Around her fingers, I say, I'm not Italian and Catholic. This is too much to bear. I tell her I already know all this. And Paige says, shut up. She leans back. So who's my father, I say. She leans into my mouth, and the string snaps between two back teeth. The taste of blood pools around the base of my tongue. She's squinting her attention deep into me and says, well, if you believe in the Holy Trinity, you are your own father. I'm my own father. Paige says, my point is that your mother's dementia appears to go back to before you were born. According to what's written in her diary, she's been deluded since at least her late 30s. She twangs the string out, and bits of food flick out onto her coat. And I ask, what does she mean, the Holy Trinity? You know, Paige says, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, three in one, St. Patrick and the Shamrock. She says, could you open a little wider? So just frigging tell me, flat out, I ask her, what does my mom's diary say about me? She looks at the bloody string just yanked out of my mouth, and she looks down at my bits of blood and food flicked onto her lab coat, and says, it's a fairly common delusion among mothers. She leans in with a string and loops it around another tooth. Bits of stuff, half-digested stuff I didn't know was there. It's all breaking loose and coming out. With her pulling my head around by the floss, I could be a horse in harness at Colonial Dunsborough. Your poor mother, Paige Marshall says, looking through the blood flecked on her eyeglass lenses. She's so delusional. She truly believes you're the second coming of Christ. Chapter 23. Anytime somebody in a new car offered them a ride, the mommy told the driver, no. They'd stand at the side of the road and watch the new Cadillac or the Buick or Toyota disappear, and the mommy would say, the smell of a new car is the smell of death. This was the third or fourth time she came back to claim him. The glue and resin smell in new cars is formaldehyde, she'd tell him. The same thing they use to preserve dead bodies. It's in new houses and new furniture. It's called off-gassing. You can inhale formaldehyde from new clothes. After you inhale enough, expect stomach cramps, vomiting, diarrhea. See also liver failure. See also shock. See also death. If you're looking for enlightenment, the mommy said, a new car isn't the answer. Along the side of the road would be foxgloves blooming, tall stalks of purple and white flowers. Digitalis, he said, doesn't work either. From eating foxglove flowers, you can get nausea, delirium, and blurred vision. Above them, a mountain held itself against the sky, catching clouds and covered with pine trees and then some snow higher up. It was so big that no matter how long they walked, it was still in the same place. The mommy took the white tube out of her purse. She pinched onto one shoulder of the stupid little boy for balance and sniffed hard with the tube stuck up one side of her nose. Then she dropped the tube onto the gravel edge of the road and just stood looking up at the mountain. This was a mountain so big they would always be walking past it. When the mommy let go, the stupid little boy picked up the tube. He wiped the blood off with his shirt tail and handed it back to her. "Trichloroethane," the mommy said, and held the tube for him to see. "All my extensive testing has shown this to be the best treatment for a dangerous excess of human knowledge." She buried the tube back in her purse. "That mountain, for example," she said. She took the boy's stupid chin between her thumb and forefinger and made him look with her. "That big, glorious mountain. For one transitory moment, I think I may have actually seen it." Another car slowed down, something brown and four-door, something too late model, so the mommy waved it away. For one flash, the mommy had seen the mountain without thinking of logging and ski resorts and avalanches, managed wildlife, plate tectonic geology, microclimates, rain shadow, or yin-yang locations. She'd seen the mountain without the framework of language, without the cage of associations. She'd seen it without looking through the lens of everything she knew was true about mountains. What she'd seen in that flash wasn't even a mountain. It wasn't a natural resource. It had no name. "That's the big goal," she said, "to find a cure for knowledge, for education, for living in our heads." Cars went by on the highway, and the mommy and the little boy kept walking with the mountain still sitting there. Ever since the story of Adam and Eve in the Bible, humanity had been a little too smart for its own good, the mommy said. Ever since eating that apple, her goal was to find, if not a cure, then at least a treatment that would give people back their innocence. Formaldehyde didn't work. Digitalis didn't work. None of the natch highs seemed to do the job. Not smoking mace, or nutmeg, or peanut skins. Not dill or hydrangea leaves, or lettuce juice. At night, the mommy used to sneak the little boy through the backyards of other people. She'd drink the beer people left out for slugs and snails, and she'd nibble their jimson weed and nightshade and catnip. She'd squeeze up next to parked cars and smell inside their gas tank. She'd unscrew the cap in their lawn and smell their heating oil. "I figure if Eve could get us into this mess," she said, "then I can get us out. God really likes to see a go-getter." Other cars slowed down now, cars with families full of luggage and family dogs. But the mommy just waved them all past. "The cerebral cortex, the cerebellum," she said, "that's where your problem is. If she could just get down to using only her brainstem, she'd be cured. This would be somewhere beyond happiness and sadness. You don't see fish agonized by wild mood swings. Sponges never have a bad day." The gravel crushed and shifted under their feet. The cars going by made their own hot wind. "My goal," the mommy said, "is not to uncomplicate my life." She said, "My goal is to uncomplicate myself." She told the stupid little boy morning glory seeds didn't work. She'd tried them. The effects didn't last. Sweet potato leaves didn't work. Neither did pyrethrum extracted from chrysanthemums. Neither would sniffing propane. Neither did the leaves of rhubarb or azaleas. After a night in somebody's yard, the mommy left a bite out of almost every plant for people to find. "Those cosmetic drugs," she said, "those mood equalizers and antidepressants, they only treat the symptoms of the bigger problem. Every addiction," she said, "was just a way to treat this same problem. Drugs or overeating or alcohol or sex, it was all just another way to find peace, to escape from what we know, our education, our bite of the apple." "Language," she said, "was just our way to explain away the wonder and the glory of the world, to deconstruct, to dismiss." She said people can't deal with how beautiful the world really is, how it can't be explained and understood. Ahead of them, on the highway, was a restaurant, parked all around with trucks bigger than the restaurant itself. Some of the new cars the mommy didn't want were parked there. You could smell a lot of different food being fried in the same hot oil. You could smell the truck engines idle. We don't live in the real world anymore, she said. We live in a world of symbols. The mommy stopped and put her hand in her purse. She held the boy's shoulder and stood looking up at the mountain. Just one last peek at reality, she said, and then we'll have lunch. Then she put the white tube in her nose and breathed in. Chapter 24. According to Paige Marshall, my mom came from Italy, already pregnant with me. This was the year after somebody had broken into a church in northern Italy. This was all in my mom's diary, according to Paige Marshall. My mom had gambled on some new kind of fertility treatment. She was almost 40. She wasn't married and she didn't want a husband, but somebody had promised her a miracle. This same somebody, they knew somebody who'd stolen a shoebox from under a bed of a priest. In that shoebox was the last earthly remains of a man, somebody famous. It was his foreskin. This was a religious relic, the kind of bait used to draw crowds into churches during the Middle Ages. This was only one of several famous penises still around. In 1977, an American urologist bought the inch-long dried penis of Napoleon Bonaparte for about $4,000. Rasputin's foot-long penis is supposed to lie on velvet in a polished wooden box in Paris. John Dillinger's 20-inch monster is supposed to be bottled in formaldehyde at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. According to Paige Marshall, it's in my mom's diary that six women were offered embryos created from this genetic material. Five of those never came to term. The sixth is me. It was the foreskin of Jesus Christ. This is how crazy my mom was. Even 25 years ago, she was this cracked. Paige laughed and leaned in to floss the teeth of another old woman. You have to give your mom credit for originality, she said. According to the Catholic Church, Jesus was reunited with the foreskin at his resurrection and ascension. According to the story of St. Teresa of Avila, when Jesus appeared to her and took her as his bride, he used the foreskin as her wedding ring. Paige snapped the string out from between the woman's teeth and flicked blood and food onto the lenses of her own black glasses. The black brain of her hair tilted from side to side as she tried to see the old woman's top row of teeth. She said, "Even if your mother's story is true, there's no proof the genetic material came from the actual historical figure. It's more likely your father was just some poor Jewish nobody." The old woman in the recliner, stretching her mouth around Dr. Marshall's hands, rolled her eyes to stare at me. And Dr. Marshall said, "This should make it okay for you to cooperate." "Cooperate?" "With my course of treatment for your mother," she said. "To kill an unborn baby." I said, "Even if I wasn't him, I still don't think Jesus would approve." "Of course he would," Paige said. She snapped the string to flick a lump of tooth jam at me. "Didn't God sacrifice his own son to save people? Isn't that the story?" Here it is again, the fine line between science and sadism, between a crime and a sacrifice, between murdering your child and what Abraham almost did to Isaac in the Bible. The old woman pulled her face away from Dr. Marshall. Tonguing the string and bits of bloody food out of her mouth, she looked at me and said in her creaking voice, "I know you." As automatic as sneezing, I said, "I'm sorry. Sorry I fucked her cat. Sorry I drove over her flower beds. Sorry I shot down her husband's fighter plane. Sorry I flushed her hamster down the toilet." I sighed at her and said, "Did I forget anything?" Paige said, "Mrs. Tunemitsu, I need you to open wide for me." And Mrs. Tunemitsu said, "I was with my son's family, dining out, and you almost choked to death." She said, "My son saved your life." She says, "I was so proud of him. He still tells people that story." Paige Marshall looks up at me. "Secretly," Mrs. Tunemitsu says, "I think my son, Paul, always felt like a coward until that night." Paige sat back and looked from the old woman to me, back and forth. Mrs. Tunemitsu clasped her hands together below her chin, closed her eyes, and smiled. She said, "My daughter-in-law had wanted a divorce, but after she saw Paul save you, she fell back in love." She said, "I knew you were faking. Everyone else saw what they wanted to see." She said, "You have an enormous capacity for love in you." The The old woman sat there smiling and said, "I can tell you have the most generous of hearts." As fast as sneezing, I told her, "You're a fucking wrinkled old lunatic." And Paige winces. I tell everybody, "I'm tired of being jerked around, okay? So let's just not pretend. I don't have fuck for a heart. You people are not going to make me feel anything. You are not going to get to me. I'm a stupid, callous, scheming bastard. End of story." This old Mrs. Tunamitsu, Paige Marshall, Ursula, Nico, Tanya, Lisa, my mom. Some days, life just looks like me versus every stupid chick in this whole damn world. With one hand, I grab Paige Marshall around the arm and yank her toward the door. Nobody's going to trick me into feeling Christ-like. "Listen to me," I say. I shout. "If I wanted to feel anything, I'd go to a frigging movie." And old Mrs. Tunamitsu smiles and says, "You can't deny the goodness of your true nature. It's shining for everyone to see." To her, I say, "Shut up." To Paige Marshall, I say, "Come on. I'll prove to her I'm no Jesus Christ. Anybody's true nature is bullshit. There is no human soul. Emotion is bullshit. Love is bullshit." And I'm dragging Paige down the hallway. We live and we die, and anything else is just delusion. It's just passive chick bullshit about feelings and sensitivity. Just made-up subjective emotional crap. There is no soul. There is no God. There's just decisions and disease and death. What I am is a dirty, filthy, helpless sexaholic. And I can't change, and I can't stop, and that's all I'll ever be. And I'll prove it. "Where are you taking me?" Paige says, stumbling, her glasses and lab coat still flecked with food and blood. Already, I'm imagining junk so as not to trigger so fast. Stuff like pets soaked in gasoline and set on fire. I'm picturing the dumpy Tarzan and his trained chimp. I'm thinking, here's just another stupid chapter in my fourth step. To make time stand still. To fossilize this moment, to make the fucking last forever. I'm taking her to the chapel, I tell Paige. I'm the child of a lunatic, not a child of God. Let God prove me wrong. He can nail me with a lightning bolt. I'm going to take her on the frigging altar. Chapter 25. It was malicious endangerment this time, or reckless abandonment, or criminal neglect. There were so many laws the little boy couldn't keep them straight. It was third-degree harassment, or second-degree disregard, first-degree disdain, or second-degree nuisance. And it got so the stupid boy was terrified to do anything except what everybody else did. Anything new or different or original was probably against the law. Anything risky or exciting would land you in jail. That's why everybody was so eager to talk to the mommy. She'd been out of jail for only a couple weeks this time, and already stuff had started to happen. There were so many laws, and for sure about countless ways you could screw up. First, the police ask about the coupons. Somebody had gone to a downtown copy shop and used a computer to design and print hundreds of coupons that promised a free meal for two, a $75 value with no expiration date. Each coupon was folded inside a cover letter that thanked you for being such a valued customer and said the enclosed coupon was a special promotion. All you had to do was to eat dinner at the Clover Inn restaurant. When the server presented the bill, you could just pay with a coupon, tip included. Somebody did all that, mailed out hundreds of these coupons. It had all the earmarks of an Ida Mancini stunt. The mommy had been a server at the Clover Inn for her first week out of the halfway house, but she got fired for telling people stuff they didn't want to know about their food. Then she just disappeared. A few days later, an unidentified woman had run screaming down the center aisle of a theater during the quiet, boring part of some big fancy ballet dance. This is why the police got the stupid little boy out of school one day and brought him downtown, to see if maybe he'd heard from her, from the mommy, if maybe he knew where she was hiding. About the same time, several hundred very angry customers flooded into a fur salon with 50% dip coupons they got in the mail. About this time, 1,000 very scared people arrived at the county sexually transmitted disease clinic, demanding to be tested after they received letters on the county letterhead warning them that some former sex partner had been diagnosed with an infectious disease. The police detectives took the little stooge downtown in a plain car, and then upstairs in a plain building, and sat with him and his foster mom, asking, "Has Ida Mancini attempted to contact you? Have you any idea where she's receiving funds? Why do you think she's doing these awful things?" And the little boy just waited. Help would come soon enough. The mommy, she used to tell him she was sorry. People had been working for so many years to make the world a safe, organized place. Nobody realized how boring it would become, with the whole world property lined and speed limited and zoned and taxed and regulated, with everyone tested and registered and addressed and recorded. Nobody had left much room for adventure, except maybe the kind you could buy. On a roller coaster, at a movie, still it would always be that kind of faux excitement. You know the dinosaurs aren't going to eat the kids. The test audiences have outvoted any chance of even a major faux disaster. And because there's no possibility of real disaster, real risk, we're left with no chance for real salvation, real elation, real excitement, joy, discovery, invention. The laws that keep us safe, these same laws condemn us to boredom. Without access to true chaos, we'll never have true peace. Unless everything can get worse, it won't get better. This is all stuff the mommy used to tell him. She used to say, "The only frontier you have left is the world of intangibles. Everything else is sewn up too tight. Caged inside too many laws." By intangibles, she meant the internet, movies, music, stories, art, rumors, computer programs, anything that isn't real, virtual reality, make-believe stuff, the culture. The unreal is more powerful than the real, because nothing is as perfect as you can imagine it, because it's only intangible ideas, concepts, beliefs, fantasies that last. Stone crumbles, wood rots, people, well, they die. But things as fragile as a thought, a dream, a legend, they can go on and on. And if you can change the way people think, she said, the way they see themselves, the way they see the world, if you can do that, you can change the way people live their lives, and that's the only lasting thing you can create. Besides, at some point, the mommy used to say, your memories, your stories and adventures will be the only things you'll have left. At her last trial, before this last time she went to jail, the mommy had sat up next to the judge and said, "My goal is to be an engine of excitement in people's lives." She'd stared straight into the stupid little boy's eyes and said, "My purpose is to give people glorious stories to tell." Before the guards took her into the back wearing handcuffs, she'd shouted, "Convicting me would be redundant. Our bureaucracy and our laws have turned the world into a clean, safe work camp." She shouted, "We are raising a generation of slaves." And it was back to prison for Ida Mancini. Incorrigible isn't the right word, but it's the first word that comes to mind. The unidentified woman, the one who ran down the aisle during the ballet, she was screaming, "We are teaching our children to be helpless." Running down the aisle and out a fire exit, she'd yelled, "We're so structured and micromanaged. This isn't a world anymore. It's a damn cruise ship." Sitting, waiting with the police detectives, the stupid little shit-faced troublemaker asked if maybe the defense lawyer Fred Hastings could be there too. And one detective said a filthy word under his breath. And right then the fire alarm bell went off. And even with the bell ringing, the detective still asked, "Do you have any idea how to get in touch with your mother?" Screaming against the bell, they asked, "Can you at least tell us who she might target next?" Shouting against the alarm, the foster mother asked, "Don't you want to help us help her?" And the alarm stopped. A lady stuck her head in the door and said, "Don't panic, guys. It looks like another false alarm." A fire alarm is never about a fire, not anymore. And this dumbfuck little boy says, "May I use your bathroom?" Chapter 26. The half moon looks up at us, reflected in a silver pie tin of beer. Denny and me in somebody's backyard, and Denny kicks away the snails and slugs with little kicks of his index finger. Denny lifts the pie tin full to the brim, bringing his reflection and his real face closer and closer until his fake lips meet his own lips. Denny drinks about half the beer and says, This is how they drink beer in Europe, dude.
Out of slug traps?
No, dude, Denny says. He hands me the pie tin and says, flat and warm. I kiss my own reflection and drink, the moon watching over my shoulder. On the sidewalk waiting for us is a baby stroller with its wheels splayed out wider at the bottom than the top. The bottom of the stroller drags against the ground, and wrapped in the pink baby blanket is a boulder of sandstone too big for Denny or me to lift. A pink rubber baby head is balanced inside the top edge of the blanket. About having sex in a church, Denny says, tell me you didn't. It's not so much that I didn't, I couldn't. Couldn't bone, shaft, drill, core, screw, all those euphemisms that aren't. Me and Denny, we're just two regular guys taking the baby out for a stroll at midnight. Just a couple of nice young guys in this fine neighborhood of big houses, each set back on its lawn. All these houses with their self-contained, climate-controlled, smug illusion of security. Denny and me were about as innocent as a tumor. Harmless as a psilocybin toadstool. This is such a fine neighborhood. Even the beer they leave out for animals is imported from Germany or Mexico. We hop the fence into the next backyard and snoop under the plants for our next round. Ducking to look under leaves and bushes, I say, dude, I say, you don't think I'm a good-hearted person, do you? And Denny says, hell no, dude. After a few blocks, all those backyards of beer, I know Denny's being honest. I say, you don't think I'm really a secretly sensitive and Christ-like manifestation of perfect love? No way, dude, Denny says. You're an asshole. And I say, thanks, just checking. And Denny stands up using just his legs in slow motion, and in a pie tin between his hands is another reflection of the night sky, and Denny says, bingo, dude. About me in the church, I tell him, I'm more disappointed in God than in myself. He should have hammered me with a lightning bolt. I mean, God's God. I'm just an asshole. I didn't even take off Paige Marshall's clothes. Still with her stethoscope around her neck, dangling between her breasts, I pushed her back on the altar. I didn't even take off her lab coat. The stethoscope against her chest, she said, go faster. She said, I want you to stay in sync with my heart. It's not fair how a woman never has to think about shit to keep from coming. And me, I just couldn't. Already, that Jesus idea was just killing my heart on. Denny hands me the beer and I drink. Denny spits out a dead slug and says, better drink through your teeth, dude. Even in a church, even laid out on an altar, without her clothes, Paige Marshall, Dr. Paige Marshall, I didn't want her to become just another piece of ass. Because nothing is as perfect as you can imagine it. Because nothing is as exciting as your fantasy. Breathe in, and then out. Dude, Denny says, this has got to be my nightcap. Let's get the rock and head home. And I say, just one more block, okay? Just one more round of backyards. I'm not near drunk enough to forget my day. This is such a fine neighborhood. I jump the fence to the next backyard and land on my head in somebody's rose bush. Somewhere a dog's barking. The whole time we were up at the altar, me trying to get my dog hard, the cross polished in blonde wood was looking down on us. No tortured man, no crown of thorns, no flies circling and sweat, no stink, no blood and suffering, not in this church, no rain of blood, no plague of locusts. Paige, the whole time with a stethoscope in her ears, just listened to her own heart. The angels on the ceiling were painted over. The light through the stained glass window was thick and gold and swimming with dust. The light fell in a thick, solid shaft, a warm, heavy shaft that spilled on us. Attention, please. Would Dr. Freud please pick up the white courtesy phone? A world of symbols, not the real world. Denny looks at me, stuck and bleeding from the rose thorns, my clothes ripped, lying in a bush, and he says, okay, I mean it. He says, this is for sure last call. The smell of roses, the smell of incontinence at St. Anthony's. A dog's barking and scratching to get out the back door of the house. A light comes on in the kitchen to show somebody in the window. Then the back porch light comes on, and it's amazing how fast I tear my ass out of the bush and run to the street. Coming the other way on the sidewalk are a couple, lean together and walking with an arm around each other. The woman rubs her cheek on the man's lapel, and the man kisses the crown of her head. Denny's already pushing the stroller so fast the front wheels catch in a sidewalk crack, and the baby's rubber head pitches out. Glass eyes stare wide open, the pink head